Welcome to another That's a Dive. I'm Kyle Martino. Good guest, if you already figured that one out. I've got PM with me, producer Mike. He's not with me, actually. He's at his house, and I'm at my house. We're doing this blind. We're doing this on the World Wide Webs because producer Mike has many things going on in his life that are more important than That's a Dive. And
That's not true. I disagree with that statement.
But great to have you guys with us again. One thing that I love to do at the beginning, and this time I've got a couple of funny ones. I love to read reviews because you guys are the best for listening in. You're the best for reviewing the show. And again, I don't know why it helps, but it does. Just believe me. I believe the person that told me that, and we're going to keep going with that. So one of the things we've been doing is put in your favorite movie line or movie reference. And the first one has one of those. Kyle was great is the topic. Wonderful topic. Thank you so much. B Street 19383 said, as a college student who walks aimlessly around campus to my dorm, this podcast keeps me going. Remember dorms? I can actually remember my college dorm. It was called Dobie, which was so weird. Anyway, that was a tangent. I really enjoy listening to Kyle's opinions, and his insight on the game is great. I do have one criticism. I agree that Messi is the best player ever in caps, yet to say Argentina's team has no decent players. Come on, Kyle. I would just love to discuss that further. I mean, he's right.
Yeah, he's kind of right players on
Messi's yeah, Argentina. Yeah, I mean, you kind of have a really good point there. Leave it to the college student to come up with a good point in the reviews. Anyway, keep it going. Great work. You may have adopted the darkness of the state of Georgia, but I was molded by it, is his movie reference. And I honestly, I've been thinking about this one. I'm not really sure where that's from. I think maybe it could be from Dark Knight. So, college student, B Street 19383. I don't know if you can do another review, but or hit me on at Kyle Martino. Let me know if I'm right because I have absolutely no idea. That one went over my head. And then my worst review yet, PM. I got my worst review yet. Three stars.
Yeah, I really wanted to include that just to make you want to work harder.
Just humble me a little bit. Yeah, and just let me know. I still have a long way to go. Love to hear him talk, exclamation point, but he it doesn't continue the subject, so let me just get on to the critique. Three stars again. Of course, Kyle embarrassed himself on TV by saying that there is no incentive to win Europa League. I think he means incentive, which is funny that he's critiquing me for a mistake by making a mistake, which he should have rectified by now, but didn't. Otherwise, it's nice to listen to him rambling on and still trying to be within the time frame of a topic. Please, please stop saying Pep's football is beautiful. And then he goes on to talk about how Pep's football isn't beautiful. That's from Ankit Chaturvedi.
Sounds about
Chaturvedi.
Right.
Chaturvedi. Yeah, that sounds about right. Sure. Ankit, I love you, man. Thanks for thanks for the three stars. I'll take what I can get on this podcast. Let's dip right into it, Mike, and see if we can actually beat three stars and get two stars this time. The three topics to go along with Ankit's three stars that he gave me are North London. Something massive happened in North London, the North London Derby, in the context of the power shift up there and London Gunners falling down. The next topic, Moyes, Sunderland, speaking of going down, relegated. And then the first topic is a very meta one. This podcast is called That's a Dive, as you know. And this topic is diving in the game. We saw two pretty bad examples of it this weekend. You see it every weekend, but this one I think was exceptionally bad in terms of some high-profile games, some high-profile players. Rashford doing it in Manchester United against Swansea. And then Leroy Sané, right? That was the other one. Some youngsters. They're learning it young these days. And Sané went down a little bit.
Sané went down against Middlesbrough, and that's a team fighting for their life. So
yeah, so massive implications for a little bit of deception. So let's start by, you know, diving in the game. All right, diving in the game, it bothers everyone. And it used to be because we were trying to sell this game, right? I mean, we're trying to sell this game in the States to all the other sports fans. We have the biggest sporting market in the world. And we've been trying to gain respect in the marketplace for a long time. I don't really feel, I mean, I definitely don't feel the need to do that anymore and don't feel any insecurity or chip on my shoulder about this game. I mean, everyone will concede it's the biggest game in the world. I mean, you know, the Manchester United or the North London Derby, for instance, probably did like, you know, 500 to 600 million households worldwide. I mean, the Super Bowl doesn't even do that worldwide. So that was a regular season game. So we don't really need to talk about, is this game big? Is it important in the States? It is. But you still sort of cringe when you hear the one criticism of the game that us soccer nerds and lovers of the game kind of can't stand and know that they have a point. Diving. It looks stupid. It makes our game look like what it looked like the type of game that they're insulting. You know, like guys tiptoeing around the field and falling over with the wind. You know, it's like that's the one area where I'm kind of like, yeah, you're right. I hate that too. And so there's always been this debate about, you know, let's get it out of the game. Let's find a way to get diving out of the game. And we'll get on to suggestions for solving the issue in a moment. But first, diving in a sort of black and white scenario, I don't fall into the camp of, you know, diving's cheating. Get it out of the game. Because there's an aspect of it that is art, that is part of the game. If you manipulate a defender or you manipulate the ball and get a defender off balance and you have them in the palm of your hand, they're lunging, they're struggling to make a challenge, and you get to the ball first or your deception is so good that they think the ball is going to be one place where it isn't, and you use that leg extended, that arm extended, and don't avoid it. You use it to run into it and fall over. In my book, and in many people's book, that's not diving. That's part of the art form of the game. Of, you know, it's kind of like in basketball when you pump fake and you get a guy up in the air and you jump into him when you shoot. You know, that's you're manipulating that guy's movement. But no one has a problem in basketball when you do that. You know, Kobe Bryant and some of these guys that were so good at getting defenders to fall for fakes and then using their body's momentum against them. There's nothing wrong in the game with being a little bit deceptive and using a defender's poor positioning against him. Now, what I definitely have a problem for is when it's blatant. When it's a just flagrant deception where there's absolutely no contact, or you manipulate the contact in such an artificial way, you manufacture it by moving your body into a position it shouldn't be in that you weren't going towards, that's when I have a problem. So I know it's kind of semantics here. There's a fine line of, you know, there's a defender's leg there. You could jump over it. But your natural movement, if the leg wasn't there, would be to run straight. So it's not as if you're doing something unnaturally. You're doing something that you would naturally do if that leg wasn't there. So I might be losing a few people, but I just think that there is a part of the game that diving is acceptable. And that, you know, that's something that I'm not going to concede on, and I'm not going to step back from, is that, you know, maybe it's because, full disclosure, I was a bit of a diver. Let's just throw that out there. I was one of the guys that a strong breeze could knock me over from time to time. And I wouldn't say it was bad enough to develop a reputation per se, but I would fall into the diver camp. And Mike, I'm sure that you're snickering a little bit. And another full disclosure, we haven't told this on the podcast before. Mike and I have some history. We actually grew up in the same town, played for the same high school team together, and then somehow through just remarkable coincidence and serendipity ended up at NBC Sports together. So I'm sure that, Mike, you are biting your tongue a little bit, and you would admit that there were times where I could be a diver.
I'm happy that you were the first one to say it. I wasn't. But I think that your diving went along with the points that you're trying to make, which I buy. There's a skill, these skilled players that are fleet of foot that can get around these lugs that play in the back, and occasionally they're late to a ball and they catch you. It's not really enough that you're going to go down, but it's throwing you off. It's affecting your next step. It's affecting the way that you're going to touch the ball when you come down next. I'm fine with you going down. I'm fine with that going down, that scenario. But I want to talk specifics about this weekend, specifically those two dives by the young guys, Rashford and Leroy Sané. For me, those were really bad dives, and they won penalties off of them. There's just that gray area where it's like, okay, diving's fun. It's part of the game. There's an art for it. But then you have these situations where both games ended up in a draw, but that's a very important point for those two teams. And conversely, 2 points drop for those other teams.
So, yeah, there were major, not only were the dives in isolation without context, just sort of embarrassing, but they had major implications, to your point. So it's a problem. It's not only a problem aesthetically in our game, it's a problem because, kind of like our VAR conversation, and VAR is relevant to this discussion. You know, you want integrity. You want the right calls. You want the game's integrity to be protected. And human error is part of the game. But when referees are running around and the game's full speed and they have guys just completely trying to deceive them in these egregious ways, it's a major problem. So here, let's talk about solutions. You could, I think most people will fall into the camp of they might not be okay with in-game sort of VAR. So having video assistant referees, having someone in a booth, in a truck, or in the stadium watching a screen and saying, by the way, Rashford completely dove there. There was no contact. He just dropped to his knees and hit his knee against the goalkeeper's arm. But that's not a penalty. I like that. I think that's a great solution, but some people aren't ready for that. So let's talk about how to disincentivize. I don't know. I'm gonna have to ask the college student that's walking around on his campus right now that gave me that movie quote.
That guy's walking around aimlessly. He's not gonna be much help.
He's he's trying to find his dorm room. So he's not even listening right now. So the way you do it is retrospective punishment. And it's not money. You can't fine these guys. I mean, some of these guys, I mean, Rashford, although, you know, he's young and hasn't signed the big, big contract yet, is probably on 50, 60,000 pounds a week. I mean, you know, I don't think a fine is really moving the needle all that much. You have to take games away from these guys. So you need to go back and watch that footage. And just like, you know, talking about Manchester United, just like Zlatan Ibrahimovic got banned for that elbow on Tyrone Mings, you know, you go back and you review it. Have a panel take a look and have it be so you feel comfortable. When you're taking games away from players, it needs to be unanimous. Have a panel that it has to be unanimous. An ex-ref, an ex-player, an ex-coach, however you want to set it up. Was that a dive? Yes, yes, yes. Okay, 3-match ban. I mean, it's got to be big enough where you make a dent in the... It's a split-second decision, and sometimes it's difficult for players to change their behavior, but it will happen. You will burn it into your split-second reflex if you're missing games because of diving. So I think that those are two ways to get rid of it. And, I mean, I want VAR. I think VAR is easy. You take a look at that in a second. And here's the thing is – to your point about the implications, VAR not only would have not only keeps people from diving, or it won't completely get it out, but it will, I think, minimize its occurrence. But the implications. So if you go on Monday and you say Rashford suspended 3 games, you know, Swansea still struggle. Swansea still didn't get maximum points, or to your point, Middlesbrough and Leroy Sané. So people are suffering because it takes so long for them to get to the right decision. That was never a penalty. And diving is a bad part of the game. So we can solve two problems at once. One is that referees can't see everything. Don't blame the referee for this, because in live time going full speed, that looks like a penalty sometimes. It does. And these referees get crushed on social media, and everyone sits at the bar and bitches about them afterwards. But their job is so hard because people are so good at doing it. They're so good at making it look like there was contact. So that's one thing. The next thing is get the right decisions. One penalty changes games. It gets teams relegated. It makes people lose their jobs. It makes players get sent to different clubs or drop down different divisions or not sign new contracts. I mean, now I'm just grandstanding a little bit, but we need to stamp it out.
We need to stamp it out. I don't know if I'm in the same boat as you that it's time for VAR to review that kind of stuff. I think you retroactively review this stuff, you punish these players severely, and it'll stop eventually. It might not be immediate, but it'll eventually stop.
Yeah, but this is my podcast, so my vote is weighted.
Your vote's so weighted. Yeah, way more.
I get the tying vote as well, and I think the VAR should come.
Well, hopefully.
So that moves us.
Yeah, hopefully Middlesbrough aren't relegated because of this, which then.
Well, no, Middlesbrough are relegated because of the last 4 months.
That's true.
So unfortunately, we can't really bail them out based on one bad call.
But there you go. I was cueing you to the next segment that you wanted to discuss.
As much as Robbie Musto would like that, right. That we're not bailing them out. Who's definitely not getting bailed out? Sunderland, relegated. And before I get into Sunderland, if there's some sound issues with the podcast, it's because Mike has better things to do and we couldn't do this in a studio. We covered that earlier on in the pod. But just bear with us because we're trying out some new technology. I mean, we're very advanced with this podcast. So on to topic two, David Moyes. So there's kind of two topics here. And we'll conflate them because David Moyes is the manager of Sunderland. But Sunderland Football Club, a massive, huge club in the Northeast, a staple of the Premier League for sure. I mean, they've been there for the last 10 years, and have spent the majority of their time as a club for sure in the first division. This shouldn't surprise anyone, of course. It's for the past 4 or 5 seasons, they've been battling in relegation fights. They make this miraculous recovery at the end of the year by hiring on a new coach who only coaches for a couple of months and then gets fired right afterwards. And it's like reality TV. It's hard to watch, but you can't change the channel. And finally, Sunderland have been relegated. And if you listen to David Moyes at the beginning of the season, it's almost as if he was resigned to accept that. I mean, he sort of, if you play some of his sound bites from the first couple of months of the season, it sounded like they were already relegated. I mean, he was very pessimistic about their chances to stay up. So why are they going down? Let's sort of take David Moyes out of this. They're going down because season after season, they are desperate to buy talent, and they continue to add aging, past their prime, or poorly scouted talent that are on enormous wages. They have one of the top 10 wage bills in the Premier League. I mean, it's amazing. In terms of recruitment, this is as bad as it gets. If you're grading their recruitment, it's an F. I mean, they season after season are either in January where players are the most expensive, the most overpriced, or in the summer where they dither around and just either because Ellis Short wants to sell the club and is trying to keep spending at a minimum, they try to go for bargain buys, or they overspend on players that everyone else knows isn't going to cut it. I mean, it's kind of like what happened to QPR when they went down. So here's a team that has a wage bill that should have them battling for Europa League, yet they're relegated. So there is a feeling around the club that Ellis Short just wanted to sell and wasn't really involved, wasn't there for the day to day, and wasn't putting his effort into things, and that also things were run so poorly that they had allowed the debt to get so high, the wage bill to get so high, while there are redundancies and people are losing their jobs within the club. And season after season, it's like Groundhog's Day. They just go through the exact same problems, the exact same issues, and no one revamped the club. No one came in and just gutted the place and decided to build to build everything again. Now, part of the reason they couldn't is because of all the contracts they had, and players were never going to get the salaries at other clubs that they were on at Sunderland, so they would just stay there. They would just stay there and wait it out. Now relegation comes, and for some, they think it may be a blessing. Maybe it's like Newcastle. Newcastle go down, they get rid of some high earners, they get rid of some small hearts, and they rebuild. People continue to come to the games. At St. James's Park, there were still huge crowds. I mean, they had the biggest crowd in the championship. I think the highest attendance the whole season was a game against Leeds. And they had Rafa Benitez, who stuck with them when they went down. And they had a plan. And going down humbled them and made them sort of acknowledge all of the mistakes and all of the flaws. There's an argument that maybe that can happen with Sunderland. I just don't think they're in as good a position as Newcastle were. But they will maybe have the same scenario with David Moyes that they had with Rafa Benitez, as someone that goes down with them. So that kind of moves us on to David Moyes. David Moyes, PM. At Everton was thought of as one of the best Premier League coaches, established the club. They battled with relegation. He went through, you know, good budget buys and promoting youth to get them into mid-table stability, and even you know, just striving for and coming close to finishing in top four positions. I remember one season. Well, so
03-04,
the job there was remarkable.
03-04, he 04-05, he got them into the Champions League. They finished.
Yeah, well, I mean that's remarkable, absolutely remarkable. And one of the reasons he was given the Manchester United job was not only that one season where he overperformed, as he said, and got them in the Champions League, but the body of work was so big, and in a league where tenure is short and it's knee jerk reactions, David Moyes was one of the longest tenured managers behind these big dogs, behind Sir Alex Ferguson and Arsene Wenger. So he's given the Manchester United job. Not asked if he'll take it, but sort of it's bestowed on him. Sir Alex Ferguson goes to his house and says, "You're taking it." And it was his dream job. He had to take it. But ever since then, it's just been misery for him. And you know, you feel bad for him because his stats compared up against Jose Mourinho and Louis van Gaal's, he didn't do that poorly at Manchester United. But I think perception kind of was something that people struggled with. Was Louis van Gaal's a winner, Jose Mourinho's a winner, they've coached big clubs, they've won big trophies, and they didn't look at David Moyes the same way, and so he didn't get the benefit of doubt. So he moves on, he goes to Sociedad, and actually helps, you know, stabilize the club to keep them up, and then the next season, they're miserable and terrible, and his confidence wanes, results go south. You know, he never learned the language. He never acclimated. He still was using a translator. And so all of a sudden, he comes back to Sunderland, a team in perpetual downward fall. And he's struggling himself with now people trying to remember what was good about him. Remember that this is actually a great manager. And, you know, his demeanor in the media, he wasn't given really the transfer window because Sam Allardyce dithered so much with the decision to take the England job. He was left with no summer transfer window. All he did was bring in players he knew from before, mostly Everton players that, you know, like Steven Pienaar were past their prime. And now you're left feeling like, here's Sunderland, a great club in demise. Is David Moyes a great manager in demise as well? I mean, are they sort of a sort of just miserable couple that will commiserate? Or is there still greatness in David Moyes in terms of what he was capable of at Everton? Can he do that with this Sunderland project?
Well, a question that I have for you, Kyle, is as a player, can you sense a manager losing his confidence?
Totally.
So does that permeate down to the team and they're looking around at each other and saying, this guy's lost it?
What I wonder is, I just wonder if the way he was talking about the club and sort of the airing the dirty laundry and almost just being so critical of them from day one was his way of just knowing that this project's broken. I'm not going to be able to fix it. No one can fix it before me. We need to get relegated and we need to clear house. And getting relegated is the only way we can kick out all of these freeloaders. I just wonder if it was that, or if it's the more concerning thing of he's just a guy that doesn't remember how he did it before and doesn't really have total belief in himself anymore. And if that's the case, players smell that. And if you have a locker room that sense a manager is questioning himself, the clock is ticking. That doesn't last very long. And I'd be amazed with how long he's been in the game and what he did at Everton if that was the case. But his demeanor, his words, the team's performances, they all point towards a guy that got his dream job and, you know, met his soulmate and got his heart broken and just can't get back in the saddle, can't go date again. And, you know, the off the field stuff with what, you know, what he was a part of with the female reporter that he just his behavior is abhorrent and ridiculous to try and no one's going to try and defend what he did. If you didn't see it, just Google it or ask a friend. They'll tell you that this guy basically threatened a female reporter for asking a difficult question. So that's following him around as well. And by the way, even the greatest of managers, think of Jose Mourinho and how he treated the female physio, Eva Caniero. That really was one of the biggest pieces of his demise. And that's a guy that's the most successful ever manager for the club he was at that still sacked him. Obviously, results went south, which made it easier. But I look at a situation where David Moyes is kind of like the last shot here. I can't see him getting another Premier League job if he can't fix things. Sunderland, last time they were relegated, I think they went up the same. It only took a year. I think they bounced right back up, just as Newcastle did. People are going to be expecting that. But man, what a challenge he has. And I just fear that David Moyes, the David Moyes that we knew at Everton, not only because of the blows to his ego and his confidence, but also the game's changed a bunch. I mean, their revenue is going to be cut in half. I mean, the parachute payment is huge when Sunderland goes down to try and help ease the blow. But the TV revenue in Premier League now means that all of those other clubs are just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So even if they do bounce back, they're going to be much weaker than all the teams that are sitting around there that have enjoyed the Premier League revenue for a couple of seasons. So Sunderland, a great club in dire straits for sure. All right, let's move it on to PM, another great club. And I don't think it's hyperbole to say in a bit of demise. The North London Derby happened, the last one at White Hart Lane, and Spurs won, and Spurs looked irresistible, looked as good as they've looked recently. After struggling a bit in the first half, I'll say, Arsenal did start the game really well. But Freudian slip. But Arsenal
That's unfair to Arsenal fans, Kyle, right there.
That's remarkably. I guess, well, listen, they could be relegated from the top four. That's that's equally as important to Arsenal fans as the Premier League is to Sunderland fans. So that game, that Spurs win was historic because it's the last North London derby at White Hart Lane, but more historic in the fact that it meant St. Tottenham's Day was canceled. The day that Arsenal fans under Arsene Wenger have always had every season in the 2 decades he's been there, where they celebrate the point in the season where they are mathematically guaranteed to finish above Spurs for the first time, is done. Spurs are going to finish above Arsenal this season. In the same season, maybe, that Arsenal are going to finish outside of the top four. So the big question ends up being, is this just a blip? You know, is this just a flare-up and Spurs are just, you know, overachieving, having a remarkable season, and it just so happens to coincide with Arsenal having a one-off bad season? You know, Arsene Wenger sort of, I'm sure, wants to believe that and made that point where he said, listen, you know, mathematically you have to expect this to happen. You know, 1 year in 20-some-odd years isn't a change in the paradigm. It's what should happen. You know, I mean, and he's kind of, he's right in sort of a philosophical sense. Logically, you know, if a team is dominant, but just, you know, when you go to play roulette, The house has the odds, but you win from time to time. So the fact that Arsenal continued season after season to finish above Spurs was remarkable, because there were some really, really good Spurs teams in that stretch. So he wants to believe this is just, you know what, we're having an off season, they're having a good season. But that's not it. That's definitely not it. I mean, Spurs have constructed a team with a lot less money than Arsenal have constructed theirs. They're a team of younger, less experienced players. They're a team of a younger, less experienced coach who hasn't won anything. There's no reason Spurs should be as dominant as they are in terms of Arsenal. And last season, they should have finished above them as well. The only reason they didn't is because Spurs were chasing a title and Arsenal weren't. Arsenal were out of the title race, which made the end of the season much more comfortable for them, which, by the way, is the way every season in the last decade ends with Arsenal, is that they're out of the title race and they go on this amazing finish because they have no pressure really anymore. So last season, even though Arsenal just at the end of the, you know, the last weekend finished above Spurs, Spurs were better than Arsenal last season. And don't let the table fool you. So this is two seasons in a row, really. And this is a team with Mauricio Pochettino that gets better every season, that gets better every game, that's signing players to new contracts. While Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez are you know, holding out, and there's no guarantee that those guys are going to re-up, every big player, save for Kyle Walker, has signed a new deal at Spurs. Everyone's on board with Mauricio Pochettino. There's a chance. Who knows? They could win the title this year. I know it's an off chance. I know it's an outside chance, but there's a better chance that Spurs win the title this year than Arsenal in any of the past, you know, seasons where they capitulate in the same predictable way. So, I kind of feel like there is a little bit of a shift, and I think that shift will continue to be more defined, more definitive, more real if Arsene Wenger stays. If Arsene Wenger stays, then for me, that locks in that there's a shift in power in North London. The new stadium coming for Spurs is going to help their revenue. As Thierry Henry and some of the Arsenal greats are saying that they're going to struggle to get world-class players, they're headed in an opposite direction. So Arsenal fans, I love you. And by the way, Arsenal, season after season, as frustrating as they are one of the teams I enjoy watching the most. And they've had players over the years that I love the most, that I enjoy watching the most. Arsene Wenger is an incredible coach who has a remarkable eye for talent. But every time someone talks about Arsene Wenger recently and makes an argument for him staying, they basically kind of talk about his eye, his ability to see talent, you know, and how long he's been there, what he's delivered in the past. I mean, basically, you have the most overpaid scout in all of the game. There's got to be more to it. He's got to be the type of guy that can show a tactical nous and a humility, which kind of moving to a back three recently suggests that he's trying to show, but that he can admit his failures and spend big in the transfer window, spend more time working on not having the ball, team shape, and how they defend, doing all these things that are just, I think, minor tweaks to make them a title-winning team.
Let me just ask you two questions. First one related to Wenger, second one related to Tottenham moving forward. This season, especially the end of the season, has been wearing on Wenger in the media. He's usually calm, composed. He's the professor. This weekend, he walked out of a press conference on a pretty innocuous it wasn't a very difficult question that he was asked.
No.
And you could see the
I've never seen that before, Mike.
I've never seen it before either, and you know, I'm back there cutting those interviews all the time. Why, or rather, can he handle another season of this pressure? Let's say they start off slowly. What is going to happen to this guy if he sticks around for another couple months? This team is going to be in trouble.
It's a good question, and let me clarify my statement before. We've seen managers walk out of interviews all the time. Jose Mourinho has made that an art form. I've never seen Arsene Wenger walk out of an interview like that. I mean, I've seen him get annoyed. I've seen him get really annoyed at some of the questions he was asked, but it wasn't a very innocuous. It was a very innocuous question. It was a question he's gotten a lot of times, which I'm sure is why he doesn't like to answer it. Which is, before the weekend, what happens if Spurs finish above you? How important is finishing above Spurs? And you know, the North London Derby, the shift in power. He's been asked that so many times. He's never had to answer it in his entire tenure when they are finishing below Spurs. It's the first time ever. So if the first time ever in his tenure, he can't handle the question, how does it feel to finish below Spurs? I worry that, yeah, this is a powder keg. It's a pressure cooker. This is only going to get worse. It's only going to get harder. Now, has Arsene Wenger dealt with pressure his entire career? Of course, especially after the Invincibles. Expectations for that group were sky high for the last 4 or 5 years after that. Then the rest of the Premier League started to catch up. You know, Abramovich comes along, starts to spend billions. Manchester City with Sheikh Mansour comes along, starts to spend billions. So I think the move to the Emirates and all of the other factors of the money in the game, it sort of assuaged concerns with Gunners out there that Arsene Wenger wasn't cutting it anymore. You know, they kind of looked at all these things and said, yeah, they're mitigating circumstances. We've got to pay for the debt, right? The debt of this big new stadium. Once we get that covered, we're going to start to spend big again. Yeah, all this big money into the game, whatever. We have a proven coach. We have some of the best quality players. We've got a style of play. We have a remarkable stadium. We're going to start to win titles again. The Arsene Wenger out, the Wenger out crowd is as loud as and big as I can remember. I think the biggest and the loudest it's ever been. It still doesn't mean it's the majority, but it's an ever-growing presence that is only going to get worse, especially as Spurs get better. If that continues, I mean, I think Arsenal fans are hoping that Wembley isn't going to be kind to Spurs when they move there next.
That was my second question that I wanted to ask you. Is there any truth to this idea that a lot of experts are saying that Wembley is going to halt this progress of this young and exciting Spurs team? Is this going to prevent
it
them from taking the next step? And how
it could.
Explain that a little bit, because as a non-professional, I don't understand how could that impact. It's a bigger stadium, more crowd, more Spurs fans cheering them on. What's the holdup? What's going to prevent them from moving forward?
That's a really good question, PM. So look at the best example, current example, is look at what's going on with West Ham. So West Ham moved from the Bowling Ground, a place that has history, where it has memories. You know, you can kind of like the house that you grew up in, and you could walk through it with your eyes closed, and you open the cabinet to get some chips out, and it has your height, you know, starting from 2 years old, drawn on the cabinet door. That does something to you. That elicits memories. It motivates. It makes you feel. It makes you feel capable of more. You know, it can do something to your sort of your mental strength and your psychology. And those are linked. I mean, the mental aspect of the game, the physical aspect of the game are inextricably related. I mean, you can't divide those. So being in a new stadium, I mean, just think about moving into a new house. You're not sure where you're going to put everything. You're not really sure how to decorate it, and that this door is kind of funky. You never realized that you have to open a certain way. It just, you have to grow into it. And that growing process is hard. And here's the extra problem for Spurs is, not only are they leaving a beautiful historic place that's like an old friend that just immediately puts you at ease, and also the sort of inverse, where teams going there have bad memories. They always think of, man, how hard it is to go play there. So both of those are erased. And here's the problem with Wembley is the bad memories are for Spurs. They keep losing in FA Cups there. They just lost another one, another semifinal FA Cup game that was a heartbreaker. Mm-hmm. That keeps happening to Spurs. So not only are they going to a new place, but they're going to a new place that has negative memories, which, like, I mean, that's a double whammy right there. So they've been trying as hard as they possibly could to get very creative with the construction of the new stadium. So the new stadium is basically eating White Hart Lane right now. They've torn down one corner of White Hart Lane, and the new stadium kind of juts in and encroaches on that corner flag. They were hoping they could continue to build parts of the new stadium and stay in White Hart Lane next year. That's costing them a lot of money to come up with this creative way to do it. The reason they're spending millions of dollars to delay the move is because they know that psychology exists and they're going to struggle. That being said, I don't think it will be anywhere near the dip we're seeing with West Ham. And, you know, this still is a project heading the right direction. But your point, if I could bring it back to North London, if Spurs struggle next year and Arsenal finish above them, that doesn't mean that Arsenal are back. That doesn't mean that they don't have the problems that they have. That doesn't mean that things are still expiring under Arsene Wenger and they're still not spending enough in the transfer window. They're still not identifying the type of players that could turn them into title winners. I mean, if I hear Arsene Wenger talk about another player that he should have bought that would have helped them win a title, but he didn't, I don't even know what I'm gonna do. I'm speechless. Every time he does that, I want to like throw something at the TV, and I'm not even an Arsenal fan. I can't imagine what Arsenal fans feel like when they hear that he looked at N'Golo Kanté, but decided not to buy him. Yeah, you spent more on Granit Xhaka? I mean, don't ever admit that. That's negligence. And yeah, are they different players in a certain way? Yeah, but you needed an N'Golo Kanté much more than you needed a Granit Xhaka. So I think we're seeing a shift in North London, and if Arsene Wenger stays, I'll say it, that shift will be locked in. I think Arsenal still can use this season, that will be the most disappointing season in Arsene Wenger's tenure. They can use this season to say, thank you, Arsene Wenger, we love you, we're going to put a statue outside, you've done so much for us, now it's time to go. And that will be the best thing they can do to make sure that Spurs don't become the new club in North London.
Okay. North London.
That's it.
North London. Remind the audience, you had a good movie title for what's going on there. They might have missed that at the top.
What was that London Gooners Falling Down?
Yeah. Great movie.
It's a great movie. Yeah. It's a great movie. And maybe that was the movie that the guy walking aimlessly around the college campus right now, his quote was from. He's so prescient. He thought it was prophetic. He thought I would come up with a movie, and he gave the quote for it. Hey, you got to hit me. I know you're listening right now, my man, and thank you for the review. And just tell me what movie that is, because it's killing me. At Kyle Martino, hit me up. And for the rest of you, please review the show. It helps. Again, I have no idea why, but it helps. And what I'm going to do is the movie quotes, because they're embarrassing me that you guys are young whippersnappers and I'm not seeing the same movie you're seeing. Just review the show. Review the show, and I'm going to read my favorite reviews at the start of every pod. So that's this one. Thank you, PM. Thank you, listeners. And remember, Tad Potters, stay on your feet.